help but be affected by this man.
Okay,
so this is the point we're making here, that, you know, God sends his his messengers.
He sends his
messengers. God's message is established. There's no denying it. Mm. You can kick and scream and fight. You're not gonna win
anything
against God.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And when it's necessary, God suddenly brings someone and it shakes the world. It completely changes the way things are done. As we spoke about in the previous programs, you know, if you look at the Islamic world, there's pre-Imam Khomeini, there's post-Imam Khomeini.
Well, yes.
You know, if you look at the Ummah.
Yes.
I mean, it affected everyone. Those who hated Ahlul Bayt, and those like the Takfiris and the Wahhabis whose izzat is being connected to the Zionists and the Americans, they got more angry.
Yes.
They got more vicious.
They
got more, you know, nasty. Mm. And those, which is the mass and the majority of the Muslims, became more self-confident. Became more
assertive.
Spiritual, more religious.
Mm.
They were reawakened. Mm. So all this...
And they do carry the badge, if I can put it that way, the badge of... I remember this myself, the small picture of the imam that we used to wear in our younger days. We used to wear that with pride.
Exactly.
And that was not, that was
interesting,
that was a phenomenon that
it's
was not
interesting
there
you mentioned
before.
That, you know, during the Bosnian War. This is in the 90s.
Yes.
During the war in Bosnia.
Yes, I remember. Yes.
You know, you had many of the Bosnian soldiers wearing imam's picture.
Picture, yeah. And that said everything.
You know, they're Sunni.
Yeah.
Right.
But that said everything, didn't
you know?
It? Yeah.
But for them, this was the image and the symbol of Islamic power.
Power.
Of dignity, of somebody who, you know, is a spiritually clean and pure person. You know, we talked about the way he lived himself.
Sure.
This is you see, imam is the kind of person we want to be.
Be. Exactly.
You know, we look at imam and we're like, you know, this is the kind of person you want to be.
I think on that note, Dr. Matthew Tarabi, I think that's something we should be thinking about day and night, actually, because, you know, even those of us who are past 40 should still think that there
those,
is room
those
for...
Those bad habits
yeah,
have
still,
you know,
room for some reformation.
Those roots
there,
are
I
being
so,
getting
because,
thicker every day.
You know, because time is passing us, but at the same time, I do believe that what you say there in terms... Because imam was a great model of emulation for us in the 20th and 21st century, still is, and will be for a long time to come. And, you know, we should get as much benefit and immerse ourselves in this man as much as we can to get as much benefit as we can out of this while we still have time. But
inshallah.
Thanks very much, Dr. Matthew Tarabi, for your contribution today. It's been really great. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening today, and goodbye.
And welcome back to The Light. An annual light festival lights up the Danish capital, Copenhagen, bringing color and life to the city amid the coronavirus pandemic. Architectural lighting, designs and pieces have adorned the city in the winter season, attracting many visitors. Some 30 light installations are located in and around the city, spreading on the bridges, buildings and squares. The organizers have planned two routes, each 3 kilometers long, so visitors can enjoy the festival while practicing social distancing.
A light festival in these dark times is very nice. It's some brightness in your life. You get stimulated through the art. And
this is the fourth year the Copenhagen Light Festival is taking place. However, this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, guided tours, talks and pop-up events have been cancelled. Instead, the organizers have prepared an interactive map so visitors can find routes and information about the installations.
humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of a panda is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around North America to within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, around Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rathwell has sailed all over the world, including three previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at that time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation. An American artist has committed himself to drawing 50,000 bees on buildings around the world. Matthew Willey, who has painted murals for 25 years, came up with the idea after a bee buzzed into his room. His goal is to raise awareness about saving the little fuzzy insects. 50,000 is the number of bees in a healthy, thriving hive in nature. During the past 5 years, Willey has painted over 5,500 of the insects in 30 murals.
My goal has always been to be in every type of neighborhood in the world. So that would be all of the continents, all of, you know, I can't literally paint bees in every community, but to take a cross section and say, you know, in every type of place, these bees have been painted, because I'm really, even though it is a healthy hive of bees that visually will be painted, it's really us. I'm painting the human race into this collective hive.
Willey says many people have so far supported his project with their donations. He hopes that his murals prompt people to rethink their relationship with nature. Bees and other insects are constantly facing a range of threats, from the use of pesticides to habitat loss and climate change.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
40% of mid-range teachers in the U.S., those with 21 to 30 years of teaching experience, the people who are mentors and leaders in many schools, have indicated that they are likely to resign or retire early. This is really disturbing. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Eleanor J. Bader, journalist. This article is published under the heading, In the Absence of COVID Safety Plans, American Teachers Are Resigning and Retiring Early. Stay tuned for the details, please. This should have been Cheryl Doberly's 40th year as a teacher, but in August 2020, she resigned from her position with the Duval County Board of Education in Jacksonville, Florida. It was dreadful to think about continuing, Doberly told reporters. I would not have been able to stay safe because I was responsible for teaching to the entire school, 500 to 600 kids. The job, she says, required her to go from classroom to classroom, even though the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned that signing with others can spread COVID-19. The job was not worth my life, she says. Like Doverly, Kristen Weher, also a teacher, left her position in the Metro Atlanta area this fall. She had taught for just 3.5 years. When the schools closed in March, I had a great remote teaching experience, she says. The students were very engaged, and despite some initial disorganization, it worked well, and I ended up loving teaching from home. But when Vehar's district decided to move to a hybrid school in October, holding in-person classes from 7:15 a.m. to 2:15 p.m. 4 days a week, with Wednesdays as a remote teaching and learning day, she resigned. The reason was fear of catching and spreading the virus. My mom is 63 and she lives with me, Vehar told reporters. She is a 3-time cancer survivor and an amputee with a compromised immune system, so there was absolutely no way for me to give her the care she deserves and continue to teach in person. A fall 2020 survey conducted by the National Education Association confirms that neither Doverly nor Vehar are unusual. Teachers with less than 10 years in are leaving the profession, NEA President Becky Pringle told reporters. And 40% of mid-range teachers, those with 21 to 30 years of teaching experience, the people who are mentors and leaders in many schools, have indicated that they are likely to resign or retire early. This is really disturbing. Michelle Fleece, a technology teacher in a Brooklyn, New York elementary and middle school, has taught for 23 years and is in this demographic. I can't get my position once I've put in 25 years and reach age 55, she says. I have less than 2 years to go, and while COVID is not the only reason I want to leave the profession, it is a factor. Her fury toward the City Board of Education is palpable. Staff, she says, are treated disrespectfully, not told whether they will be working remotely or in person until the last minute. A few weeks ago, we got called at 8:30 at night and were told that the next day we'd be teaching remotely. We then had to start making calls and emailing the families about the change. We were also expected to immediately pivot our lesson plans from in-person to online instruction, Fleece told reporters. It's frustrating to not know what to prepare for. It also seems unfair not to know what's happening until the last second. This has happened many times since September. Thank you. These, Pringle says, are frequent complaints, but she continues, the NEA survey revealed another even more horrifying trend. Nearly half of the teachers of color interviewed, including 43% of black teachers, told researchers that the decision to stop teaching has been hastened by COVID. Nonetheless, it's not the only reason they are dissatisfied. When we talk about diversifying the field, we have to take on institutional racism, Pringle says. We know that people of color are being disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. Teachers of color are fearful for their own and their family's health and are less trusting that the government will do anything to protect them. Pringle also notes that teachers of color tend to work in schools that are under-resourced, less able to provide enough personal protective equipment, PPE, and space to make socially distanced learning possible. Yet, despite pervasive racial inequities, Pringle reports that when surveyed, neither veteran nor new teachers cited combating racial bias, an admittedly huge problem, as the most critical issue facing them. Instead, she says, they reported that their jobs would be far more satisfying if they felt appreciated and valued. When pressed on specifics, she says that the school personnel want to be included in decision-making, receive support to develop the skills needed to teach effectively, whether in person, fully remote, or in hybrid classrooms, be provided with adequate PPE to protect themselves and their students, and to be able to rely on school-based services to assist students who are dealing with a host of traumas. No district had a line item in last year's budget called coronavirus, but we need to deal with it and work collaboratively to address a number of urgent needs, including the disruption of education provoked by the virus, Pringle told reporters. Pringle added, we know that black, brown, and indigenous students, homeless students, low-income kids, and kids with disabilities did not have the same access to technology as their richer peers. We need to address these gaps and do it in a way that acknowledges that these gaps have existed forever. We then have to reclaim public education as a racially and socially just public good that can prepare every single one of us to succeed in our lives. The challenge, according to American Federation of Teachers, AFT, President Randy Weingarten, is that there are 13,000 disparate school districts across the U.S. and no consensus on how best to teach during a pandemic. She blames this on the Trump administration, which she charges offered absolutely no guidance to localities. Not only that, but because of austerity measures that began more than a decade ago, many towns and cities face a shortage of teachers, experienced substitutes, paraprofessionals, and other support staff pre-pandemic. These losses, coupled with the layoffs of an additional 688,300 public educators from pre-K to college level between the start of the pandemic and September 30, have left the school administrators scrambling and overwhelmed. Worse, she continues, all of the information unions have about teachers leaving and retiring early is anecdotal, since the Department of Education did not deign to collect data on this. All of this has created the conditions for the exodus of thousands of dedicated educators, folk frustrated by continued cutbacks, layoffs, and ever tighter budgets, larger classes and increased workload, fear of catching the virus and infecting others, and a lack of confidence that administrators and lawmakers will come together to develop a strategy for mitigating the pandemic and supporting public health. Another less talked about issue, Weingarten says, is the development of a plan to provide reasonable accommodations, including the ability to work remotely for those who need them. When the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, was passed in 1990, no one foresaw the need for accommodations that address someone's fear of bringing a virus home to a family who is immune compromised, Weingarten said. As written, the ADA has stringent requirements for who gets or does not get accommodation. Only people with physical or mental impairments that limit their functioning are considered disabled. But with COVID, people can spread the virus even if they are asymptomatic and may need to work remotely to protect others. Face-to-face.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Face-to-Face. I'm Houman Abedi, and in this program, I'm going to have an interview with Iran's energy minister, Dr. Reza Ardakhanian, who's here with us to share his thought with us. Dr. Ardakhanian, thank you very much for accepting invitation. As the first question, please explain in general about the achievements of your ministry, especially after the victory of the Islamic Revolution back in 1979, in the field of water and electricity supply to remote areas of the country.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Ministry of Energy in Iran is in charge of water and electricity. In general, means thermal power plants, hydropower plants, and renewable energy. And when it comes to the water, it's about constructing and managing large dams, as well as irrigation and drainage networks. Also distributing water for different sectors, for domestic, in urban and rural areas, also for agriculture, for industries, and providing water for environmental protection. My ministry also collects wastewater and try to treat them and reusing treated wastewater. So all in all, this ministry deals with each and everyone in the country, in urban areas, in rural areas. And day and night, we have to provide enough safe and clean and secure water, as well as electricity for the whole population. 42 years ago, when Islamic Revolution came on stage, and we started to serving our people in different way, that time the installed capacity in terms of power plants was just about 7,000 megawatts in the country. And nowadays, while population is 2.3 times, the installed capacity of power plants is about 12 times than that time. So it means that we have achieved a good level of progress, as well as facilities, not only for domestic purposes but also for development of the country in different area, because of the role of energy as an infrastructure. Also, we have started recently working on renewable energies in terms of wind and solar. For sure, 42 years ago, it was zero. And now we have about 870 megawatts of solar and wind renewable energy. And in terms of hydro, also we have established many large dams with hydropower facilities, and I think it's more than 12,000 megawatts, while this number was less than 2,000 40 years ago. This has provided us a good infrastructure in the country, and also in terms of water, if we look at the statistics worldwide, this time in the urban areas, the coverage in the world is about 96%. For electricity in Iran is 100%. And in rural areas, for electricity, the coverage worldwide is about 79%. In Iran is 99.7%. So it means almost each and everyone in the country has access to electricity. When it comes to the water, the situation even is more brighter. Mm-hmm. And I may say 42 years ago, we had just four wastewater treatment plants in the country located in four major cities, and none of them was able to cover the whole city. And it I think less than 2 million population were covered by wastewater treatment plants. Just a few days ago, our president inaugurated, among many other projects, one of the high-tech wastewater treatment plant in Kurdistan province in Kamyaran, and it was number 246, means that we have designed and constructed and operated 242 wastewater treatment plant during these 4 decades. But most of the progress came during the last 7-8 years. And now we are in the position of reporting that every month we are inaugurating one wastewater treatment plant. Every 2 months we are inaugurating one water treatment plant. And every 50 days, less than a month, during the last 7 years, we have inaugurated and operated a new large dams. So this means that Iran is in a good shape in terms of infrastructure for water and electricity.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your thorough answer. Would you please tell us more about the progress of the Ministry of Energy in recent years in terms of export of energy, especially, I mean, electricity to other countries?
So when we have established power plants 12 times than it was 40 years ago, while the population has been increased just less than 2.5 times. It means that we have invested a lot for the network. So we are in a good location in terms of geography. We have good connection with all neighboring countries. I may say from southeast with Pakistan, then Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Turkey, Iraq, which with each and every neighboring countries, we have electricity connection. Exporting, importing, it depends on the time of the year. In some cases, we are just exporter. In some cases, we have transaction of energy in different months of the year. And we think that in the near future, we may also bring renewable energy in this network to be exported to the neighboring countries. We have announced to all investors in private sector that we provide them permission and access to our network that they export their own say, electricity generated by wind towers and solar panels to the neighboring countries based on the contracts they signed with them. So I think right now we are in a good shape. If ourselves do not need electricity, we can, I mean, provide it to neighboring countries. And in some cases, we are importing when we need them.
Thank you. Today we are witnessing the export of technical knowledge of Iranian specialists abroad. Can you please elaborate that in which countries we have implemented or we are implementing projects both independently or jointly with other countries?
Look, in the world, usually they remember Iran as a country with major sources of oil and gas as the source of wealth in this country. But in reality, our major wealth is our human resources. And if we utilize this source in a right way in terms of education, training, and using human resources in the right places, I think we are good enough not only to respond to the needs of our country, but also we may have a major role in development and progress of the region. As you mentioned, many Iranian contractors and consulting engineers right now are active in the region, even outside our region. They are working in Africa, and they are winning the bids for major projects in terms of designing and building large dams, hydropower plants, thermal power plants. It's now, I believe, 6 years consecutively that Ministry of Energy of Iran, means that water and electricity sector in Iran is in the first place in terms of exporting technical services and engineering services worldwide. So we have thousands of companies now are active in building equipments in energy sector, and many companies both in consulting engineering area as well as contractors working on large dams, on designing and constructing water and wastewater treatment plants. This is another source for employment and also for a good level of friendship and connection, especially with the neighboring countries.
Can you please tell us the name of some of these countries that currently Iran is implementing?
So we have worked and we are working in Iraq, mainly in the energy sector, while also in other part of development in Iran. In Iraq, Iranian companies are active. Minister of Energy now, based on the decision of the Iranian government, is in charge of joint economic commission between Iran and different countries. I myself am in charge with Iraq, with Armenia, Russian Federation, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, as well as state of Qatar in the region, and some other countries like Sri Lanka outside our region. So in Iraq, we have major projects, mainly in the energy sector, but also in other part, in construction of sport fields, as well as dam construction. In Tajikistan, we have constructed hydropower plants, also working on the road construction and connecting different parts of the countries in terms of using TBMs for tunnel projects. In Sri Lanka, the Iranian companies have designed and constructed and operated a major hydropower plants. Soon will be officially inaugurated by officials of both countries. In Africa, many Iranian private sector companies are active in different projects.
Very well.
Dr. Ardakunian, many say that the world's future war would be over water. And in face of water scarcity across the globe, what are the energy ministry's mechanisms to cope with this issue?
If many say and talk about war on the water, so it means that not all the people, and some of them do not talk about the war, and I am among those people who are not a believer in the war on the water. And instead, I think that those people who are talking about the war on the water in the future, they are somehow paving the way for some potential conflicts. And they want to normalize this issue of conflicts on the water. Then they go for fishing themselves out of these potential conflicts. But regardless of this argument, Iran is in a very unique situation worldwide in terms of shared water and inter-boundary basin issues. We have many countries in the world that they are in living in the inter-boundary basins in terms of water and sharing water with their neighboring countries. But they all are either upstreamer or downstreamer. If they are downstreamer, like for example in MENA region, like a big country like Egypt, they know what to do as a downstreamer, right? And this position affects on different area in terms of even engineering, mathematical modeling, and so on. And some countries are upstreamer, and they know how to deal with the issue. But Iran is a country that is upstreamer, at the same time is a downstreamer. In the east part of the country, we are in the downstream of interboundary basin with our neighbors, Afghanistan. In the west part of the country, we are in the upstream of the basin with our neighbor, Iraq. Also, we have shared rivers in the north, northeast, northwest. We have Harirud River with Turkmenistan. We have Aras River with Armenia and Azerbaijan. So it means that Iran is in a very unique situation in terms of dealing with different aspects of the shared water and living in the interboundary basin. Is this a challenge? Yes. But also it's an opportunity. And if we do things in a correct way, if we rely on water scarcity as a source of being closer and closer and working on it as an opportunity for friendship and cooperation, then we come to the point to say that either a scarcity of water or somehow droughts and this kind of climate situation is not in a source of being worried when it comes to dealing with the neighboring countries. We can open new chapters and working with our neighbors to share benefits and cost of water. We can look at the water as a source of cooperation. When we have flood, when we are facing droughts, both of them can be used as the reasons to work closer with the neighboring areas. So recently we have started to establish a national center for shared water and interboundary basin issues to, improve the level of cooperation, first of all, at the national level between different ministries and authorities, and then going to our neighboring countries and offering many different projects for cooperation. So in the long run, I think we can take advantage of water scarcity in our region to work closely with our neighboring countries and share whatever of the knowledge and experience and technical expertise that we have with our neighbors. And I think it will help us to overcome the negative aspect of water scarcity. So all in all, I do not believe in war on water.
And are all of our neighbors willing to cooperate in this regard?
When it comes to development, we should know that the main aspects of development is the human resources development. Building dams, power plants, roads, and other facilities and infrastructures alone is not the sign of development. The major and main development aspects in the mind of the people. That's why that right now in the world they do not divide the regions or the countries to developed and developing. And they talk about the people. Either I am a developed citizen worldwide or I am a developing. So we have to invest and work more on education and training. And I'm sure that in our region with lots of cultural connection that we have with our neighbors, we can build upon that bridge and work together. I may say that we have good sign of interest from our neighboring countries working together, and so the people should not be worried about that.
I do really appreciate your full comments, Dr. Adakanyan, and I wish you all the best in your career.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this edition of Face to Face. I'm Human Abedi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The pandemic has led to a dramatic increase in the number of American people who say their mental health has suffered, rising from 1 in 3 people in March to more than half of people polled by KFF in July. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Matt Wolf's editor. This article is published under the heading, U.S. states are poised to cut mental health care despite rising demand under COVID. Stay tuned for the details, please. States across the U.S. are still being hurt after businesses closed and millions of people lost jobs due to COVID-related shutdowns and restrictions. Meanwhile, the pandemic has led to a dramatic increase in the number of people who say their mental health has suffered, rising from 1 in 3 people in March to more than half of people polled by KFF in July. The full extent of the mental health crisis and the demand for behavioral health services may not be known until after the pandemic is over, mental health experts said. That could add costs that budget writers haven't anticipated. It usually takes a while before people feel comfortable seeking care from a specialty behavioral health organization, said Chuck Ingoglia, president and CEO of the nonprofit National Council for Behavioral Health in Washington, D.C. We're not likely to see the results of that either in terms of people seeking care or suicide rates going up until we are on the other side of the pandemic. Last year, states slashed agency budgets, froze pay, furloughed workers, borrowed money, and tapped into rainy day funds to make ends meet. Health programs, often among the most expensive part of a state's budget, were targeted for cuts in several states across the U.S., even as health officials led efforts to stem the spread of the coronavirus. This year, the outlook doesn't seem quite so bleak due in part to relief packages passed by Congress last spring and in December that buoyed state economies. Another major advantage was that income increase or held steady for people with well-paying jobs and investment income, which boosted the state's tax revenues even as millions of lower-income workers were laid off. It has turned out to be not as bad as it might have been in terms of state budgets, said Mike Leachman, vice president for state fiscal policy for the nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. But many states across the U.S. still face cash shortfalls that will be made worse if additional federal aid doesn't come, Leachman said. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, predicted his state would have a $15 billion deficit with spending cuts and tax increases if a fresh round of aid doesn't materialize. Some states, such as New Jersey, borrowed to make their budgets whole, and they're going to have to start paying that money back. Tourism states, such as Hawaii, and energy-producing states, such as Alaska, Wyoming, continue to face grim economic outlooks with oil, gas, and coal prices down and tourists cutting back on travel, Leachman said. Even states with a relatively rosy economic outlook are being cautious. In Colorado, for example, Democratic Governor Jared Polis proposed a budget that restores the cuts made last year to Medicaid and substance abuse programs. But health providers are doubtful the legislature will approve any significant spending increases in this economy. Everybody right now is just trying to protect and make sure we don't have additional cuts, said Doyle Forrestal, CEO of the Colorado Behavioral Healthcare Council. Montana is one of the few states with a budget on a 2-year cycle, so this is the first time lawmakers have had to craft spending plans since the pandemic began. Revenue forecasts predict healthy tax collections over the next 2 years. In January, at the start of the legislative session, the panel in charge of building the state health department's budget proposed starting with nearly $1 billion in cuts. The panel's chairperson, Republican Representative Matt Ridger, pledged to add back programs and services on their merits during the month-long budget process. Republicans who are in control of the Montana House, Senate, and Governor's Office for the first time in 16 years are considering reducing the income tax level for the state's top earners, such a measure that could affect state revenue in an uncertain economy, has some observers concerned, particularly when an increased need for health services is expected. Mary Wind Decker, Executive Director of the Behavioral Health Alliance of Montana, said that health providers across the state are still clawing back from more than $100 million in budget cuts in 2017, and that she worries more cuts are on the horizon. But one bright spot, she said, is a proposal by new governor Greg Gianforte, a Republican, to create a fund that would put $23 million a year toward community substance abuse prevention and treatment programs. It would be partially funded by tax revenue the state will receive from recreational parks, which voters approved in November, with sales to begin next year. Windecker cautioned, though, that mental health and substance use are linked, and the governor and lawmakers should plan with that in mind. In public's mind, there is drug addicts, and there are mentally ill people, she said. Quite often, the same people who have a substance use disorder are using it to treat a mental health issue that is underlying that substance use, so you can never split the two out.
Ministry.
Two years have passed since the people of Iran took to the streets and brought about the Islamic Revolution of 1979 under the leadership of Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini. Today, it is a proven fact that the 1979 Islamic Revolution created great hope among the deprived nations throughout the world. What were the main factors which led to the Islamic Revolution, you may ask? A society torn between tradition and Western modernity, poverty and prosperity, dictatorship, and a yearning for democracy. The reasons are countless, but to answer the question in full, one should not look at the 1979 revolution as an isolated incident. Rather, it was the culmination of over a century's strive to end the dictatorial powers of monarchs, remove foreign influences from Iranian politics, distribute wealth while ensuring both economic prosperity and allow for central guidance and control, and to create a constitution that was both democratic and would not alienate the traditional and religious portion of the population. The world was surprised and astonished by the Iranian Revolution, which was led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in exile from Paris. The personality of Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini was a critical element in redefining Iran's role in the region. Imam Khomeini's background, charisma, and thirst for revolting for the people of Iran influenced the atmosphere leading to the revolution. One can understand Khomeini's personality and beliefs by examining his background. His devotion to Islam, reflected by his simplistic, austere lifestyle focused on spiritual matters, attracted the majority of Iranian society, which was stricken with poverty. Many of these traditional citizens flocked to the modern cities seeking opportunity, only to wind up crowded into slums. Imam Khomeini's life of suffering and final return to Iran replicated a legacy of the oppressed experience. Imam Khomeini unwaveringly opposed monarchy, arguing that only rule by a leading Islamic jurist would ensure that the true Islamic ruling was properly followed. Imam Khomeini's novel artistry was seen in the way that he took the corrupted system that had been ruling the country and replaced